Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, May the 23rd, 2024. This is episode 3497 of the Survival Podcast. I should be telling you, it's episode 3500 by now. The show got preempted this week, once for Charlie, plus me being ill, then another day for me being ill. And then yesterday, due to technical gremlins, who, I don't know, may have saved me from not looking so good on camera anyway. I was doing a pretty good job of faking it on the run-up to it, but I'm still dealing with some kind of crud that I picked up, apparently down in Bastrop. I say that. I mean, I could have picked it up anywhere. It's better, but I'm still at that state where, like, I am not on top of my game. You know, Nicole Sauce is known for her My Three Things way of getting shit done, which is every day you pick out three things that you're going to do. It doesn't mean it's all you're going to do, but those three things shall be done. And if you do that every day, you get a lot done. I texted her this morning before getting on the air, and I said I'd be happy if I could have like my one thing and be serious about it and mean it today, because I guess my one thing is going to be getting this expert counsel Q&A show out for you. I do have a good lineup of experts for you. I am going to lean on them a bit. My personal commentary will be briefer than typical in between. Some of these will be straight up intros and let you hear what they have to say, a little bit of commentary. And then I do have an anchor segment on the end, in honor of yesterday, which was Bitcoin Pizza Day. And I'm going to cover that because there's always on Bitcoin Pizza Day, all these Bitcoin experts, right? The influencers in Bitcoin. And you know, I really respect some of them. And generally, the ones I really respect aren't the ones I'm talking about right now. But there are a ton of people who have marketed themselves as influencers, whether they are or not, you know. And when you do that and you have one thing like Bitcoin, or one thing like a chick showing her ass on TikTok, or one thing like right-wing commentary, when you have one thing and you want to put out content every day, you have to have one thing that matches a new thing every day. So Pizza Day is always the day where all of these influencers, most of whom weren't even here for the block wars, many of whom are, you know, have entered the Bitcoin space in like the last 2 years. There's nothing wrong with that, but I'm just saying they haven't been around for a while. I'll tell you all about the Bitcoin Pizza Day, which I'll explain if you don't know, and then say this is the example to follow and you need to spend your Bitcoin. Bitcoin must be spent. If we're going to prove that it works, it must be spent. If you're going to know how to use it, it must be spent. I'm going to tell you why this is bullshit, and you should never listen to anybody else telling you what you need to do with your money, especially when they're telling you you need to spend it, and they don't tell you, like, well, spend it on this thing because it's valuable, or spend it on this thing because it makes sense. Like, you need to spend it because we don't have a spending deficiency in America. What we have in America and in the modern world as a whole is a savings deficiency, an investing deficiency. And Bitcoin is, at this time in history, the perfect vehicle because it's savings and investing at the same time. It's volatile. That's what makes it work. It's a feature, not a bug. So I'll cover that today. And with that, we'll just go ahead and get into it. I will give you a quick listing of the lineup today. Up first will be Ron Paul and Dan McAdams talking about Congress now wants veterans benefits, okay, U.S. veterans benefits for U.S. citizens who are not in the U.S. military that go to Israel to fight for Israel on Israel's soil, including one key benefit this is about that is ridiculous when we have U.S. veterans lining up for benefits that they've earned that they're not getting. Andy McCann will talk about handling appetite on a carnivore keto diet because sometimes it goes up. I'll tell you my thoughts on that too in addition to his. Ken Berry will talk about thoughts on cholesterol levels. Eric Hammond will talk about dealing with a remote start and check engine light on a 2016 Cherokee. That's a Jeep for the non-initiated. Doc Bones will talk about how to have that reserve supply of antibiotics on hand just in case and why you'd want to do it. Sean Mills will talk about saltwater batteries. If you don't know what they are, don't worry. You will know when Sean's done. And, of course, again, I'm going to hit you on this whole thing, this idea that you need to spend your Bitcoin. And what you really need to do is not listen to people to tell you what you need to do with your money. So with that, let's go ahead and hear this from Ron Paul and Dan McAdams. And this one kind of crosses your eyes when you even think about what our government is saying here.
So, but today, another insult to sanity. It makes no sense whatsoever. And this headline caught our attention. Here it says, GOP representatives want same benefits for Americans serving in Israel's army.
Yeah.
Serving Israel. Well, I know our position is if you're a volunteer and you want to just leave the country and go over and be in the Army, you do it on your own nickel.
Yeah.
And your own risk.
Yeah, I mean, this is breaking all over Twitter X today. So many people are talking about it. And our good friend Kelly Vlahos wrote a piece about it for Responsible Statecraft, if we can put it up. And this is the article you referenced, Dr. Paul. GOP reps want same benefits for Americans serving in Israeli Army. And she starts out by saying, it might sound like something out of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, or for a more modern twist, Seinfeld's Bizarro World. Two Republican congressmen introduced legislation that would extend the same employment protections to Americans serving in the Israeli army as Americans who leave work and home to serve in the U.S. military. And as you point out, it's never been a problem as far as we're concerned, as far as you're concerned. If you, for example, look at the fighting in Ukraine, maybe you're of Ukrainian background, what have you, whatever the case, if you want to go over there and fight for the Ukrainians, go for it, you know. And the same is true with Israel or any other country, you know, and a lot of Americans do. A lot of Americans have been killed in Ukraine fighting as mercenaries. But this is very, very different in that essentially it melds the military of the U.S. with the military of Israel. So if you're an American citizen and you don't like what's happening in the Middle East, a lot of people don't, and you go and you're working in a factory somewhere. You're going to go and join the military, not of your own country, but of Israel. If this passes and you leave your job as a baker, working in a bakery, and you go fight for a foreign country, when you come back, that bakery has to hold that job for you. So it's a huge burden on American businesses. And the other thing, and I think you mentioned it yesterday, is how American veterans are having a difficult time accessing all the benefits they were promised. You know,
right.
They're finding that the well is dry when they come to it and they need something. So this seems like a real insult to American veterans, and I wonder if the U.S. veterans groups are going to speak out against this. But the other thing, here, let's actually look at the bill, because in case people think that we are exaggerating this, this is the actual legislation. If you go to that next clip, and you're going to have to increase it a little bit. But anyway, Section 4336, Treatment of Service in Israeli Defense Forces. For the purpose of this chapter, to the extent practicable, the service of a citizen of the United States in the Israeli Defense Forces shall be treated in the same manner as service in the uniformed services. So that's exactly what these two representatives have suggested with this legislation. So it's treated just like Americans, I guess.
See, the motivation for this is similar to the motivation in hysteria after 9/11. It was terrorism. We can do anything we need to do, and no limitations. We're always fighting terrorists. So the one congressman that is pushing for this support, Max Miller from Ohio, I'm quoting him. He says, "I'm proud that this legislation extends important protections to those Americans who choose to risk their lives in the fight against terror." So this is the moral justification,
yeah.
And they may have other ones, and maybe this is truly their belief. But, you know, I think that word has been stretched a long time. You know, there's always a terrorist involved, and another reason why we have to spend another $10 billion.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big problem. And you've mentioned Max Miller from Ohio. He's up from Cahoga Falls, I think, area. But the other one is Representative Guy Reschenthaler from mm-hmm. Pennsylvania. Two Republicans from the, essentially, I guess, Midwest, you'd almost call it, who are putting in this legislation. He says it'll ensure we do everything possible to support those heroes who are standing with Israel. Now, you can applaud Americans that would go over there. You can feel proud if one of your family members went over to fight. But the idea that they're treated the same as an American, the American service member, I think most Americans, unless I'm really out of touch, would find that rather insulting.
You know what I got from that? So they did say it, but they didn't like come directly out and point this out. So I want to add this. So when you join the U.S. military and you go for 2 or 3 or 4 years, you pretty much don't get shit when you get out. You don't cost the United States military a dime or the United States government a dime when you leave, unless you are injured and disabled and subject to disability, which I guess could happen, and then would this apply to that? It's not clear. Maybe it would. And then you have a cost associated with you. About the only benefit you get is if you leave because, let's say, you're guard and you're called up, or in some cases, if you volunteer to go during time of war, what they said, that employer has got to have a job for you when you come back. They don't necessarily have to hold your job, as in not hire somebody else, but when you come back, you get that job. And that either means they have to fire the person they hired to replace you, which can lead to all kinds of problems, especially Mr. Ohio there in the Congress should know that. Like, doing that in Ohio, you're basically stuck with both people. Same with Pennsylvania. Like, either one of those are right-to-work states. Like, Texas, you could say, Bill, you knew it was only till Tom came back. Tom's back from the fight. Sorry, you got to go. Now you're saddled with multiple employees for one job, and you had to wait. This disproportionately affects the smaller businesses, and it doesn't cost the government anything. The government is always generous with your money. But they're even more generous with money that's your money that they didn't even steal yet. They're very generous with that. They're very generous with, you know, putting fees on things, taxes on things, and burdening businesses with costs when they don't even have to fund it from the money that they already stole. This is a disgrace. Because you might think, well, then, you know, they're entitled to another benefit. You don't get shit, right? You don't get shit. You get a discount at Lowe's. Thanks for your service. Fuck off. And I'm not saying that you should. Like, when you enlist, at least when I did, you knew you didn't get anything if you didn't stay 20 years. Now they have kind of like a 401k, a different type of retirement. I don't exactly know how medical benefits work today or anything. But I bet you this doesn't give them any of that. If you did go serve for, let's say, 2 years right now, if you were you volunteered, you joined the military, you came home, I don't know if you get anything. We got nothing when we came home. Like, if you didn't retire or you weren't disabled, thanks for your service, goodbye. So I don't know what else you get, but my guess is nothing. All this does is saddle small businesses. This is what was referred to, and this happens in many different ways, is an unfunded mandate. The government has mandated a thing of a group, or sometimes they do it to states, and provided no funding for it, which is typical. Which is typical. Anyway, moving on, let's hear about appetite and a keto carnivore diet from Andy McCann. And I do have a little add-on with this.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage out here in Woodstock, Georgia. And the question I have from you today is, Gabby from Ohio asks, how do you handle the increased appetite if you are doing a carnivore or keto diet? So that is a interesting question. Yes, you are going to change your hunger profile. I'm going to give you my personal experience. I have done this. I've been off of grains and sugars for 10 plus years, and I've done this twice. This time has lasted a whole lot longer. And the thing that happens is, you do want to eat more, but it's really, there's a satiation point, and it's like, I'm not getting that that feeling of like doneness from my meal. So if you are the type of person who eats a meal, like let's say you're at dinner and you eat dinner and then you want to eat like that something sweet and that like finishes dinner for you, then you've created a habit that you really need to overcome. So it's not so, sometimes it's not so much that you have the appetite that increases, but you will. It's that your ritual is not complete. So you have to fight the ritual. So I fought the ritual of sugar. Maybe I'll do a whole other like Q&A. Actually, there has been a question on sugar, so maybe I'll put it in there. But I punch sugar in the face with different flavors, so olives or cinnamon or whatever, just something different. Okay, so now back to the increased appetite. Here's a very weird thing. The math doesn't work out. So when you do a carnivore diet, and let me pull this up here. So carnivore diet is the elimination, or it's an elimination diet that consists entirely of meat and animal products, excluding all their foods. Okay, that's what the ChatGPT summary says, or the Brave summary says. And then the ketogenic diet is a half high fat, moderate protein, low carbohydrate eating pattern that aims to restrict carbohydrates carbohydrate intake so that the body can break down fat for energy. This is actually where I'm at, is kind of in this realm. So I still eat some carbs, but not much. So grains are out, which eliminates like a ton of carbs. I wanted my body to start burning fat for energy. And I will tell you this, doing CrossFit and having fat as your energy rather than carbs, it feels weird at first. And the fortunate part was I was always logging my times into our system. So we would do workout, Fran, Helen, whatever. And I could see that my times and my lifts were pretty much the same. I just felt different when my body was burning fat versus carbs. I feel okay now. It's years later and everything's fine. Or at least I don't remember what it was like to burn carbs, I guess, as your primary. But I am more hungry. So let's go back to that. Did my appetite increase? Yes and no. Once I got rid of those cravings, then I realized there was some, like, hey, I'm just actually hungry. So I eat a lot more. If you go to, like, one of my favorite places to go, we'll hit the local steakhouse, and the kids all order steak. I order a steak, and I always joke and say, hey, do you have turf and turf? Because I just want two steaks. And they're like, well, you can always buy a second steak. I'm like, I know. Thank you. But you eat a lot more. If you count, this is a weird part in the math side of it. Not all calories are created equal. You could eat a Snicker bar and see the calorie count, or you could eat three steaks. And I know the profile is different, but it just doesn't stick on you the same way. I eat a lot. I eat a lot of fat. I eat a lot of butter on all my stuff. I eat ribeye and I eat the fat of that. I eat lots of sweet potatoes. Yeah, I know. I said I didn't eat many grains and carbs, but I do eat a lot of sweet potatoes. And vegetables, which I know has carbs. I'm not against carbs. I just don't do sugar. And in order to get off of sugar, I had to stop eating carbs. Anyway, the appetite goes up. But I think the real question is not so much how do you handle the appetite, because you just eat more and that's okay. Fill yourself up. I think the real question is, hey, I'm eating more. Won't I get fatter because I'm eating more? And that's the weird part. And Jack, you can attest to this in your take on the segment here, but you don't gain weight the same way once you get off of eating all of these carbs. So like I said, I eat a lot of fat. I eat a lot of protein, and I'm a little shorter now, so I'm maybe probably just 5'8". You shrink over time, and I'm 162 pounds on average, and I eat a lot. I have some podcasts and some YouTube videos where I actually show my tracking of food for 2 weeks, and you can see how much I eat. So if you go to @AndyMcCann42 on YouTube, you'll see it. Or if you're watching this video now, you'll see it. But if you're listening on podcasts on Jack's show, then go back and look for it, and you can see what I eat. I eat a lot. So if you're asking, what do I do about the appetite? Yeah, just eat more. That's totally fine. If you're asking, will this make me fat? The weird answer is no. Fat does not make you fat. Mixing carbs, sugar, and fat? Yes. That's a recipe for disaster. I mean, we are the richest country in the world, yet we have the most like obese problem in the world. This is the only country where poverty still equals you being fat, which is weird. So don't eat the stuff that's out there that says, hey, this is, you know, convenience food. It's fun food, right? That's not really food. Eat real food. And you weirdly track it. So if you're worried about it, I mean, you can go down the rabbit hole of tracking, weighing, and measuring. I would say just pull up an app and start writing in there and see, and then step on the scale every once in a while. You're going to find over time, it takes some time for your body to regulate, that you're not going to be gaining weight. All right, guys, hopefully that's helpful. I do have other podcasts that are directly on this. You can find me on any of the podcast channels. Just look for CrossFit Garage. That's the unique name for the podcast. And we talk about there, it's Building a Firm Foundation in Fitness, Food, and Finance, which is pretty much everything that Jack talks about here on the Survival Podcast. All right, guys, take care.
So my basic answer here is the same as Andy's. If you're hungry, eat more, as long as you're eating the right. And if you're carnivore, eat until you're full. I do have a couple caveats with that, though. Number one is there's a difference between hungry and craving. And if you were a drug addict and I took away your drug of choice, you would have a craving for it. It doesn't mean you need it. And it doesn't mean you're hungry. It means you have a craving. So you do have to be careful what he kind of hit on at the beginning there. Are you craving the fact that you're not eating ice cream after dinner? Or something from the snack machine between breakfast and lunch at work? Or whatever that is. because that is habitual. It's also, he hit on the habit thing. And so habits we can break in about 7 days. But there's also a biochemical addiction that we have. And the problem with addiction is, while it can be broken almost as quickly or sometimes more quickly than a habit through cold turkey, the body remembers the impression the way that, let's say, a real vaccine, not these bullshit vaccines that they have now, these mRNA crap bullshit fake vaccines that aren't vaccines because they don't actually prevent infection or prevent spread. But a real legitimate vaccine, and there are some, that they leave the body with a memory, and that memory has antibodies and the ability to make those antibodies, and it's basically a traditional vaccine is actually using the body's immune system. You expose it to the pathogen, and it says, oh, I know this is a bad thing now, and it sees it and it goes after it. Well, that can work against you too. So if you have this habit and you have a biochemical addiction imprint on you that, hey, I like peanut butter crackers, and you eat one fucking peanut butter cracker, you're going to eat 12 peanut butter fucking crackers. And so I will caution you not to give in to those cravings and allow them to draw you into eating those other things. Because what you'll say is, well, if I ate this thing, I would stop being hungry. Well, you wouldn't, but you would kill your craving. And you can backfall on that shit so easy. I've done it. And it's always obvious what happens. And then all of a sudden, 2 hours, 3 hours later, you're having like jitters and shakes that you never had while you're on keto or while you're on carnivore. So that would be one thing. Make sure it's not actually hunger. And so that's the next thing. Give it time. There are so many times now that we'll go out, I'll order a steak, like Andy said. I can eat two steaks, whatever. Yeah. And I eat a steak, and sometimes I don't even finish the steak. And Dorothy's like, are you hungry still? I'm like, I could eat it. But if I wait 10 minutes, it goes in the box and it goes home and it's a snack the next day or it's a snack that evening. When you switch to carnivore, I also encourage you to make sure to go in with this one that you are eating high-fat carnivore. If you're doing carnivore and you're eating chicken breast, you're going to be fucking hungry and you're never going to get past it. You need to be eating marbled meat. You need to be, like Andy said, adding butter, all those things, right? You should be getting more, not more volume in fat, because volume is not what we're looking at here. If you look at a ribeye steak is the perfect fat to protein ratio for, you could eat that every day on carnivore and you would have that fat to protein ratio down. I love ribeye, but even that would get boring for me. I'm just saying, like, if you get that in your head, there's a lot of fat in a ribeye, but there's a hell of a lot more red. But there's more calories from fat than there is from the red, okay? And you need to be getting the bulk of your calories on this diet from fat, or you're not going to get satiated. All right. And if you do that again, and you give it some time, you will often find that you're really not hungry. You just wanted something else. And again, I do that all the time now. Just by, like, I'm not going to eat this. I'm going to wait 10 minutes. And if I still want food, I'll eat it. And if you find yourself going, I'm still hungry, but I don't want more of this meat, I don't want more of this cream, I don't want more of this butter, I want that piece of cake over there, you're not hungry. If you're hungry, you know, when people were starving that got lost in Alaska, after they ate their sled dogs, and they were down to nothing, they ate the leather wrappings from their sleds, and they said they used hunger as sauce. Right? When you're hungry, you'll eat. When you're like, I need to have this thing over here, not this thing over here, you're not hungry, you have a craving. So understand that component to it as well. And then understand, there is an adaptation phase. As Andy said, like, he doesn't know what it's like to get his energy from burning carbohydrates anymore. If he went back to a carbohydrate diet, even if it was the healthiest carbohydrate-based diet he could do, he would feel the same weird as when he went into a protein-fat-based diet. You're changing your lifestyle, you're going to feel weird. It takes time to adapt. So that's my additions there. Good stuff from Andy. Now let's hear about cholesterol from Doc Ken Berry.
Hey, Jack and the TSP crew. This is Dr. Ken Berry answering a question today from Rick. Rick is 48 years old, had blood work done, and his LDL cholesterol level came back at 178. Rick then gives me a lot of dietary information about what he's been eating, drinking, and avoiding. And then says, I guess my real question is, how much are all these things, the oil, the eggs, the bread, contributing to high cholesterol? Is it possible to overdo it? So here's what you need to understand, Rick. The cholesterol heart connection is a hypothesis. This means that a few smart guys got together in a room and they said, you know what? I think high cholesterol causes heart disease. And they all said, yeah, I think you're right. And that's going to be our hypothesis. Now, here's the problem with the cholesterol heart hypothesis. It's been around for decades and it has yet to be proven. There is some research supporting the hypothesis. There's quite a bit of research refuting the hypothesis. They tend to call when they find things like, oh, the French eat lots of fat, lots of butter, lots of bacon grease, and they have actually lower levels of heart disease than other countries. They call that sort of thing a paradox. Well, that's not a paradox. That's just a falsification of the hypothesis. That means that the hypothesis is either fatally flawed or just not true. My advice to you would be to stop worrying about your cholesterol and your LDL cholesterol. Focus on becoming as metabolically healthy as you possibly can. Focus on becoming stronger and faster as months go by. And I've got many YouTube videos on my channel about cholesterol. I've got a great interview with Dr. David Diamond, who spent the latter half of his career as a PhD researcher researching this very question. And I think that interview with Dr. David Diamond on my YouTube channel will clear a lot of your concerns and worries right up. Hope this helps. This is Dr. Berry. Talk to you guys next time.
And every time you ask Ken Berry that question, he's going to answer it the exact same way until it changes. Because I'm just going to say, I'm going to say, with some moderation, that, you know, if your cholesterol level is 19,000 or something, or if your other numbers, your metabolic test numbers are bad, that just high cholesterol alone being a thing that needs to be medicated or even worried about might be one of the biggest scams ever pulled off on human history on people. All it really does is sell lots of drugs, specifically statins, which probably have done more damage than good. I know there's going to be some people out there that hate me for saying that, but I will just say, prove me wrong. Show me conclusive evidence that demonstrates a conclusive link between otherwise healthy people and heart disease, between cholesterol and heart disease. So you can't show me a person that's a type 2 diabetic with an A1C of 9.1. I'm not even making that number up, by the way. With an amputated foot that had high cholesterol and said they got heart disease, so that correlates. That doesn't make any sense. You see how that doesn't make any sense? And they do this all the time. You know what a meat eater is in their studies? A person that eats pepperoni pizza is a meat eater. That's red meat. It's red. It's meat. Pepperoni and sausage pizza? Well, of course. Let's ignore the bread, the freaking highly processed cheese, the freaking insect-infused tomato sauce. And, oh, by the way, I'm not talking about the new insects. I'm talking about, do you know there's a maggot count? Most food production facilities, all these high-processed foods, like, as long as your maggot count's under a certain amount, it's okay. I'm not making that shit up. Go look into it if you doubt me. Maybe if we started making our own food again, a lot of these problems would just go away. And if we stopped listening to numbers versus physical manifestations of health, there'd be a lot less problems, too. But I know, let's just get everybody free health care and everything will be okay. All right, sure. Now let's talk about cars. How about a Jeep with Eric Hammond that has a few problems?
Greetings, Eric Hammond here. I got a quick question and answer here. It's a 2016 Jeep Grand Cherokee from a listener. He said his remote start doesn't work and he wants that working again. It's got a check engine light on and it's got an EGR or exhaust gas recirculation code P0404 or P1404 in it, and he thinks that's why his remote start won't work, and he just wants to know what part to replace. So generally, I don't recommend replacing parts whatsoever without diagnosing them first, because this can get expensive quick. But I did look into this one, and it seems like these Jeeps are plagued with bad EGR valves. There was actually a recall on these to reprogram how the powertrain control module would shut the EGR valve. It sounds like it was closing them too hard and damaging them. So first things first, I think that you want to call the dealership with your VIN number. Make sure there are no open recalls on this. If there are, you need to get that done first. Then I do think that you should replace the EGR valve. I think that will fix it. You can't just replace the EGR valve. There is a relearn procedure that has to be done with a scan tool to reset the computer and tell it that you've put a new EGR valve on. I don't think the check engine light will go out without doing that procedure. So you're going to have to pay somebody to do that, or beg or borrow somebody with a scan tool to do it for you. And I did look into the remote start for this, and it does say in the service information that the remote start is disabled if any engine warning lights are on. So if you fix the check engine light, chances are you will fix the remote start. And I think the EGR valve is the way to do it. But you got to get it reprogrammed. I hope that helps. If you have any other questions, shoot them my way. Gas, diesel, electric, two-stroke, four-stroke, whatever. If it's broken and it should work, but it doesn't, give me a crack at answering it. Thanks.
Next up, let's hear from Doc Bones on how to have a stockpile of antibiotics and why you might want to do that. Doc, take it away.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question for the expert council comes from Chase, who writes, how does one properly acquire multiple treatments of antibiotics for a rainy day? In my experience, I've only been prescribed one treatment's worth after a doctor's visit. What types of antibiotics should one have on hand, assuming there are different kinds? And what is the actual shelf life of these drugs, and do any of them become toxic, dangerous after expiration? Chase, the lack of antibiotics is one of the reasons that you see some otherwise preventable deaths in a you-know-what-hits-the-fan situation. This was first made apparent to me many years ago when I saw the History Channel presentation After Armageddon, where a family headed by a paramedic negotiates a post-apocalyptic landscape and eventually joins a community. The paramedic father is assigned a number of chores he wasn't used to performing, and that led to a minor injury which broke the skin. As you know, the skin is your armor against infection, and sure enough, he developed a local infection that sent him to the community medic, who shrugged and said there were no antibiotics in their storage. The paramedic, who knew full well the seriousness of the situation, could only watch the infection spread until it reached the bloodstream a few weeks later. He became septic and died. If there had been antibiotics available, he would have nipped that infection in the bud and not died needlessly. After watching this, I began writing about how to get antibiotics. I researched fish antibiotics, as I was at the time raising tilapia in my pond and had a supply. When I compared them to human antibiotics, I found them to only contain one ingredient, the antibiotic alone, just like human antibiotics do, and to only be available in human dosages. They were also identical in appearance to the human version, down to the numbers and letters on the capsules. Further research and discussion with pharmacists proved them to be the real thing. So I wrote the first articles encouraging the preparedness community to stockpile them in quantity. They were sold without prescription, and you can buy unlimited quantities, something that's a big plus for the survival medic. That all changed, unfortunately, a few months ago when the FDA sent Chewy.com and other distributors of fish antibiotics a cease and desist letter claiming that they never knew about these drugs, even though they were on the market for more than 30 years. Someone blew the whistles on these important survival tools for the family medic in times of trouble, and we're the poorer for it. So that only leaves a couple of online options like Jace Medical. For all I know, they blew the whistle on fish antibiotics, but you can still get a combination of antibiotics through these outlets with an application. The problem is you can only order once a year, and you can't get unlimited quantities, usually just one course of therapy for each drug. This is a problem if you're the medic for a large survival group. So which antibiotics would you consider getting? For those who aren't allergic to penicillin, I think either amoxicillin or cephalexin, both members of the beta-lactam family, would be good drugs to have around, especially for soft tissue and bacterial upper respiratory infections. Dosing is relatively simple and in most cases safe for pregnant and pediatric patients. Secondly, I would have doxycycline, which handles a lot of different infections of the respiratory and intestinal tracts and is okay to take if you're allergic to penicillin drugs, although it isn't considered acceptable for use during pregnancy. For those who claim doxycycline becomes toxic when expired, note that the Department of Defense's Shelf Life Extension Program has in the past authorized its use well beyond the expiration dates. Metronidazole is a drug that I would consider very useful, especially for intestinal infections from bacteria and certain parasites like Giardia, seen in intestinal and pelvic infections, among others. It's also used with other antibiotics and those with stubborn infections, for example, even appendicitis, along with another antibiotic for situations where surgery isn't an option. Although metronidazole is acceptable in those allergic to penicillin, it's not okay for pregnant or breastfeeding mothers. Azithromycin is known to be generally safe in pregnancy, though, as well as those with penicillin allergies. It can deal with many cases of respiratory infections, dysentery, tonsillitis, sinusitis, and more. An added benefit is that many people in your group may have taken it before in its popular Z-Pak form. The sulfa drug combination sulfamethoxazole trimethoprim is an excellent choice for many infections, especially urinary ones. If that's a common problem for certain family members, you might consider having this drug around. It's also been used for skin infections, some sinusitis, MRSA, ear infections, and others. Sulfa drugs are acceptable in the penicillin allergic, but not in the pregnant woman or breastfeeding mother. And then there's clindamycin. This has been used to treat everything from acne to anthrax, but it's helpful for pneumonias, pelvic infections, uterine infections after childbirth, soft tissue infections, even effective against MRSA. It is, unlike doxycycline and metronidazole, acceptable for use during pregnancy and in people who are allergic to penicillin. Of course, you could be allergic to clindamycin or really any other antibiotic itself. In rare cases, use of clindamycin can induce an intestinal inflammation called colitis, which could be serious. As for expiration dates, the Shelf Life Extension Program of the U.S. government has determined that many drugs, if they are in pill or capsule form, that is non-liquid, are 100% potent and safe to take years after the expiration date. They've tested over 122 drugs associated with the National Medical Stockpile. Some exceptions may occur, but are a little bit too complex for the time we have allotted. You might consider getting a copy of my book, Alton's Antibiotics and Infectious Disease, A Layman's Guide, for more in-depth information. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
You'll notice he didn't give a 30-second answer that was buy my book, but at the end he said to buy his book, and I recommend you buy his book. I really do. 100%, I think this book belongs in any prepper's library. He gave you all the information. You can write it all down. You're probably not going to remember it, especially under stress. And I'll just reiterate, you know, that this knowledge is not so that when you get the sniffles, you can go out and take fish antibiotics. It's so that you can have a stockpile of life-saving medication if we end up in a long-term situation where you are your highest level of medical support. Moving on, got one more before my segment here. Sean Mills is going to talk about something called saltwater batteries. These were news to me, so let's hear about them together.
Hey, everybody. It's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I have a question from Sam about saltwater batteries. So here's Sam. For the solar expert, I forgot his name. Do you have any knowledge or info on saltwater batteries? Are they in production to any degree or available for residential application? We just had a solar array installed and are looking to include a battery bank, but we're not excited about many of the negative aspects of the conventional battery options, like rare earth mineral mining practices and after-use toxicity. I've heard some talk about saltwater batteries, but it's been difficult finding much information about them, and I'm hoping you know something that I don't. Thank you for any light you can shed on the issue, Sam. Well, hey, Sam, that's a good question. My name is Sean Mills, by the way, and I do have some information on saltwater batteries. So saltwater batteries are essentially a redox, so a reduction in oxidation battery that uses salt water as the electrolyte, okay? And there's a lot of different options for redox batteries. The vanadium battery is probably the biggest one on the market right now. And there was a company that got a bunch of Bill Gates money and I think some government money back in the late 20-teens that was supposed to solve all the world's problems with a saltwater battery and then immediately went bankrupt. So in general, when you find a new type of battery technology that sounds really cool and it sounds like, hey, this is the thing that's going to save the planet, and then when you go research that, you can't find any information, that really gives you all the information you need. There are tons of material scientists all over the world that are looking for the new best idea for dealing with the problem that you have with wind and solar energy, which is availability and storage. Okay, so it's not always sunny, it's not always windy, so we need to store all the power that we can during the times when it is sunny and or windy, and then put that power back on the grid. And like I said, there's tons and tons of money going into R&D to try to solve this problem. And there's tons of ideas. And all those ideas work, but they're not cost effective. So anything that you can take solar power and store it for a little while and then turn around and use it when the sun's not out works, right? But if it's not cost effective and it's not viable commercially, then it doesn't really matter, does it? So saltwater batteries, right now, there's new companies on the market that are trying to get this system installed. And those systems right now are about the size of a semi-truck. And you need about 5 semi-trucks worth of stuff in order to get one solar saltwater battery up and running. Okay, and all of these new technologies, that's exactly how they're going to be deployed. They're initially going to be put into utility scale systems where there's a big utility scale solar array. They're going to use a bunch of federal and state and other incentive money to get those systems in place. And then they're going to test them and figure out whether they work or not. So the one that's closest to market right now is the iron redox system, where essentially they're going to use iron filings and they're going to rust and de-rust them to store and withdraw energy. And we'll see how that works. There's one under construction, I think in Pennsylvania right now, that's supposed to hit the market either late this year or next year. And when it's actually on the grid and operating, we'll figure out whether it really works or not. There are some saltwater batteries, and again, they're utility scale and massive, that are in place, and you know they're testing them out to see whether they work or not, but they're not commercially viable. For a home scale system, the only options that are really commercially viable right now are lithium iron phosphate and flooded lead acid. I say flooded lead acid, but lead acid is like the gel batteries, the sealed batteries, and the standard flooded batteries. Like those all fall into the lead acid category. Those are really your two options. Okay. Now you said you're concerned about the negative aspects like rare earth mineral mining and after use toxicity. Well, a lithium iron phosphate battery actually has neither one of those problems. Okay. Lithium is not a rare earth metal. And it's not toxic once it's bound up in the form that it is used for in a flooded lead acid battery. You might not know this, but lithium is actually prescribed as a medication. It's used in greases. It's used as flux for different soldering operations. There's tons of different uses for lithium all over the place. And if you think that the world's going to be destroyed by using flooded or lithium iron phosphate batteries any more than it would be by using flooded lead acid batteries, then you're just buying into the hype, okay? I'm not saying that flooded lead acid is better or worse, and I'm not saying that lithium iron phosphate is like the end all be all and what, you know, what we're going to be running on 100 years from now. I'm just saying that today those are the options, and lithium iron phosphate is the better of those two options from a cost standpoint, from a safety standpoint, from a toxicity standpoint, and from an end of use standpoint. So if you want batteries in your system, I would tell you, go get your lithium iron phosphate batteries and put them in, and then just watch the news. In about a decade, there's probably going to be another new, you know, awesome save the world option that's going to be out there, and maybe it will be commercially viable. But I think that's the earliest that we're going to see anything that's going to compete with lithium iron phosphate. Is realistically, it's going to be a decade out. They're going to have to come up with how to make it viable on utility scale with a bunch of government money pumped in, and then scale that down to a residential use application, and then get that into production, and then have it in production for a while before it's going to be commercially viable. So I know that kind of bursts the bubble a little bit, but the reality is you're not going to get saltwater batteries for the house. It's a cool technology, and maybe it'll end up being in use at utility scale going forward, and they'll start to make it smaller and smaller and smaller. But if you want a system right now, if you want some resilience right now, just go with the lithium iron phosphate. All right, guys, we'll keep getting those questions in the jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
All right, good stuff from Sean, and I know when to stay in my lane, and battery technology is not my lane, not that level of battery tech anyway. Anyway, I want to talk to you today a little bit about Bitcoin Pizza Day, what it is, what the real lesson from it is, versus the lesson influencers try to always spin out of it. So when we look at Bitcoin Pizza Day, you have to understand that when this happened in 2010, when a gentleman used 10,000 Bitcoin to purchase two Domino's pizzas. And this seems like a really dumb thing to do if you look back at it now, but hindsight is 2020. And you have to really understand the totality of this. In 2010, Bitcoin was pretty much worth zero. We didn't even have real exchanges yet. Like, the only way you could get Bitcoin was to trade something for it like this, or to use mining to acquire it. So be like, I'll go back, if I could get a time machine, I'd go back to Pizza Day and I would buy 10 million Bitcoin. Well, there wasn't 10 million Bitcoin in existence yet, and you couldn't buy it. Now, you probably could have found sellers on the Bitcoin Talk Forum and things like that, where all these guys, these technical folks were mining Bitcoin. But basically, Bitcoin was pretty much zero, right? There wasn't any real market for exchange yet. We didn't, you know, Mt. Gox hadn't even come, let alone gone yet. Silk Road really wasn't a thing yet. So it wasn't. So this guy didn't really make a mistake, because it was just a thing. And so he couldn't even buy it from Domino's. He got somebody that was willing to buy it with their credit card to buy the pizza, have it sent to him, and he transferred the Bitcoin to this person. If that person kept the Bitcoin, and we don't know if they did or not, I doubt they did, it's worth about, well, $6 million today, right? I'm sorry, $680 million, I think, something like that. All depends on where the price is. Somewhere between $670 and $680 million. Almost a, you know, 70% of $1 billion. And what this was, though, was the first real public transaction using Bitcoin. And it's celebrated, and it should be. But what these influencers want to do, most of whom are not Bitcoin people, by the way, most of the people, not all, but most of the people doing this are not Bitcoin only. They're full on shitcoiners. And I don't just mean like I used to be. I mean like they'll do reviews of shitcoins for money. We'll say this is like an impetus that you should spend your Bitcoin. You should spend your Bitcoin. And some of them at least will couch it with, I'm not saying to spend your stack, but it's important that we spend Bitcoin. And here's the problem that we have with a lot of well-meaning people in Bitcoin today. They understand that fiat is a bad thing. Fiat money is a bad thing. They understand the problems of fiat. And they even understand to a large degree the problems of thinking in fiat. But they've never known a world where money wasn't fiat. If you were born 1971 or later, you were literally never alive in a time where the U.S. dollar wasn't a fiat currency. A full, not even a, like, before that it was a, like, we had a hybrid between 33 and 71. We were kind of really a hybrid fiat. Because they rebased it artificially, they artificially pegged things, it was some bullshit. But at least there was some world in which the dollar was gold and the gold was dollar, okay? So, if you were born, let's say, in 1940, you're probably passed on by now. There's a few people maybe. Is anybody around from 1940? I I don't know. I guess, yeah, there's some people that were born in 1940 or still around. I'm sorry. Probably some of you in my audience thinking, what a jackass this guy is. You'd be 30 years older than me, so you'd be in your 80s, late 80s. So those people lived. So you got people in their late 80s, right? They lived for a time where there really was gold-backed money. They actually had jobs. They saved money. They lived in a hard money world, at least for a time. But even they then lived the majority of their adult lives in a fiat system. Most of their working life, most of their savings for retirement, most of their spending was done in fiat. There's no one alive today that really was born with hard money, grew up with hard money, worked through life earning hard money. Now, many of you know people who did. They were your grandparents, if you're like my age. And they had a real distaste for things like debt. And they lived very differently. And they seemed very obscure to a lot of society. Like in the 80s, we had the Me Generation, right? And Ronald Reagan's Morning in America and YOLO. They didn't call it that then, but that's what the whole decade of the 80s could be described of, is you only live once. We all thought we were going to die in nuclear war, and money was free-flowing, so let's spend it. Well, I was a kid then. So the 90s kind of carried that tradition on. But almost everybody alive today has lived the majority of their life with fiat currency, under a fiat standard, with fiat everything. From 1970 on, pretty much, we had fiat food, fiat houses, fiat cars. You know, Lee Iacocca, famous guy from Chrysler, he actually cut his chops in Ford, and his thing was pick any car in the lot, 50 months, $50. He was at, I think, Philadelphia is where he rolled that out. And it wasn't really any car in the lot. It was these cars over on this part of the lot. But he said, you put $50 down, $50 a month, drive any car you want from this group of cars off the lot. You don't have to worry about it. Which one, blue, green, I don't care. This model, that model, is you got AM or cassette, or didn't have cassette yet, 8-track, you know, 8-track tapes, and you just got in a car, gave him $50, and drove off. And everything became cheap monthly. And due to that, we live in a spending economy. And so one of the best pieces of advice I can give anybody, and I've done this before, but I haven't talked about it in a long time, and this is a perfect time to bring it back up. There's a book called The Richest Man in Babylon. It was written in, I think, 1928, right before the stock market crash. And it always refers to money as gold in this book, because money was gold. And there's some coppers and, you know, silvers, the smaller currencies in Babylon, but the money that's really saved and stacked is gold. And one of the best things that anybody that wants to understand Bitcoin today can do is to realize what we've done is we've made gold energetic. Now, I know when people say digital gold, people have different minds on that. And when I say digital gold, I don't literally mean it's digital gold. What I mean is it now serves the role that gold traditionally served as the governor of money, the governor of governments. That because gold could only be increased at such a rate as was possible, and a tremendous amount of energy went into doing that, and it wasn't hard-capped, but it was the closest thing to a hard-capped, verifiable monetary supply that we had at the time, Bitcoin now serves that role more perfectly. Because instead of being an element that we extract from the ground, that when we want more, we can dig deeper, dig harder, develop new technology to get more out, its issuance was designed from the beginning with an understanding of what hard money was. And so it is a constant. In fact, I say that Bitcoin is to economics what the speed of light is to physics. I've said that before too. Because it's the only true known, the only true constant. And with the constant, you can figure out the variable. The variable, you cannot figure out the constant, right? You have to know the constant to figure out what the variable is going to do. And so there is too much fiat thinking even in the Bitcoin community. Even among people who call themselves Bitcoin maximalists, they still think about getting rich quick, even if they say they don't. The one person I said this to on Primal, which is Noster, really. I have no idea where he was. I was using Primal. Said, what do you want us to do, live under a bridge and starve to death? Because I was saying not to spend any money. Well, I didn't mean not to spend any money at all. We all have to provide for our needs. We also have certain wants. What I'm saying is, don't spend any money. And by any, I mean any form, whether it's dollars, silver, gold, Bitcoin. Don't exchange an asset of known lasting value for something of declining value without really thinking before you do it. And that we don't need to spend Bitcoin to prove that it works, because we're past that. We don't need to buy pizzas. I have a shotgun worth about $1,500. I bought with Bitcoin when Bitcoin was $600. I had no money into Bitcoin. It was all Bitcoin I had earned as a referral affiliate for Coinbase back then. I mean, you used to get like 0.1 Bitcoin to refer one customer when I first started doing that. That's how cheap it was. And it had come up in value, and I had lots of Bitcoin. I had more Bitcoin then than I have now. I'm speaking from the pain of this experience. And I've often said, you know, it would have been okay if I would have just went out and bought another Bitcoin the next day for $600. But did I need to spend the $600 cash on the gun? I didn't need the gun. I'm glad I have the gun. But now I'm sitting on a gun that effectively, according to Brave Search, I paid $67,937 for. That's reality. I'm not going to turn around. You know what I'm going to say? I'm glad I have the gun. I don't hate myself for it. I don't hate the decision. But do I regret it? Yes. Would I rather have that shotgun or $67,000? I'll tell you this. I'll sell that shotgun, as long as I can legally transfer it to you, to any person who wants to give me a quarter Bitcoin for it right now. You see what I'm saying? See, all spending needs to be thought of as spending Bitcoin. This isn't really about not spending or spending Bitcoin. This is about making spending decisions, is what I'm talking about. And it's very hard for these people to understand this because they're very myopic, because they only have one thing. When you spend $1,000 this week, assuming it's discretionary spending, now, your mortgage, your electric bill, all of this shit I get, your food, and some luxuries, and some things you just want, and some things you're investing in your homestead for, I get. But when you talk about, let's say this month, $1,000 in discretionary spending, things you didn't need, they don't contribute to your future, they just make you happy. Okay, well, that's $1,000 worth of Bitcoin. But Jack, I spent fiat. But you could have spent the fiat on Bitcoin. And this is the switch that, if Bitcoin really has gotten to you, happens. You start thinking, but if I don't spend this money today, what will it be worth tomorrow? And when you're using fiat, if you seriously ask yourself that question, the answer is less. You know, probably you throw away the government's number, somewhere between 10 to 20% less. So if I spend $10 today, and then next year, if I still had that $10, it's worth more like $8 to $9 in real spending capability. So the way that we've been trained then is, well, you put some of that money, a tenth of all you earn is yours to keep, you put it into investments. But they never tell you to actually think about, but the money you didn't put in there, what would it be worth? See, that $10 invested in top-line equity funds even will be worth more money in 10 years than it's worth today. In spending power, not just in dollar value. But even that is failing to keep up on a lot of levels now. My best friend David recently said, you know, if we just put $100,000 as our new Social Security program, in each kid's name when they are born, at 50 they could have $4.5 million. The math tracks. Yeah, but it wouldn't if everybody did it. And the inflation it would cause would be insane. It only works for you, the individual. And here's the good news. Not everybody's going to do it, and the government damn sure ain't going to do it. It has always been the case. That's why this book was set in Babylon in ancient times. It has always been the case that most people piss away the majority of their earnings. And the people that don't are looked at as cheap and tightwad, etc. And then when they become wealthy, everybody says it must be nice. This is not new. In the words of a song from a cartoon movie, It's a tale as old as time. Did the fool and his money are soon parted. I really recommend you read The Richest Man in Babylon. And I really recommend when somebody tells you what you need to spend your money on, and I'm not talking about somebody selling you something. I'm not talking about somebody saying, hey, look, I have a thing. I'm talking about people that don't even know you. They don't even know your situation. And they tell you to spend your money. And here was the one comeback I got. It made a little bit of sense, but not that much if you do what we teach here. Well, one day, the central banks might issue the CBDCs, and they'll control all your money, and if you don't know how to spend Bitcoin, you won't be able to do it. Well, this is stupid. If you're doing what we teach, is what? Buy Bitcoin, get it off the exchange, and self-custody it. If you know how to transfer Bitcoin to yourself from an exchange, you know how to transfer Bitcoin, so you know how to spend it. And there's a place for learning how to use Lightning. There's a place for small amounts of money, too. You know, like getting on the Nostr network and setting up an Albi wallet, maybe using Primal, and realizing now you can buy $5 worth of Bitcoin into your Primal wallet right in the Apple Marketplace. It's KYC. It's $5. Shut up. And learning how to build networks and receive and how to exchange value with each other. And I'll never tell anybody not to send me Bitcoin if they want to pay for MSP or something with it. People pay for their workshop fees. And Bitcoin, I never say no, and I don't think they're wrong for doing it. It's money they were going to spend anyway. But this idea that if we don't spend Bitcoin, Bitcoin will suffer? It's just another way to make excuses for spending money. And that's what these people are really doing. That's what they're really doing. They're justifying their own poor saving habits by encouraging you to have poor spending habits. And how do I know this? Because it's not unique to Bitcoin. This is a fundamental problem in a society that has lived on fiat culture its whole life. So what was I called, because I said this on Nostr? A boomer. Must be a boomer. Like, if you're financially set, you must be a boomer. No, bitch, I'm Gen X, and I've been set since you were still probably having your mom wipe milk off your mouth, and I grew up poor as fuck. Why? Because I practice what I preach, right? Because I do the things that I tell you to do. People would look at me like, you, like, Jack, you know, you say not to overspend, but you spend money on all kinds of shit. Because I have it. Because I have it. And because I still continue to grow my net worth on the other side of it. That's the whole point. There is a point where you stop saving everything and start spending some, but you still should be saving. And if you live this way for a relatively short period of your life, when you're at your prime, when you work the extra jobs, when you do the side hustles, when you take the overtime, when you take every promotion, when you walk across the street and go to another company because they pay you $2 an hour more, whatever it is, when you make use of all the side hustles you can just plug into now, when you're delivering groceries or DoorDash or giving people rides on weekends instead of fucking off with your friends, that if you do it while you can also do that, while you can affect the accumulation side and the investment side simultaneously, then you can get to the same place in your 30s to your early 40s. And here's what nobody will tell you. It's fucking worth it. But no, what people want to do is cry, complain, and bitch. And just because they've discovered Bitcoin, it doesn't fix the problem. In fact, it can make the problem worse. Because what happens is people start thinking with the Bitcoin pizza day, boy, if I coulda, I woulda. No, you wouldn't have, because you coulda and you didn't. It's lottery ticket mentality. Do you know who pisses away money on a lottery? Poor people. Poor people. You know who else pisses away money on a lottery? People who won a lottery. I could win again. You get struck by lightning twice, but you know what? The guy that got struck by lightning once and lived, he doesn't worry about getting struck by lightning again. He knows that he already defined the odds once. The odds of him getting hit twice, it's like cracking somebody's Bitcoin seed. It's just not going to happen. Anyway, I really encourage you to read or listen to The Richest Man on Babylon. I'll put links in my segment notes today. Two places. One, if you just want to read it because you want to read it, I'll put a link to Amazon and you can buy it. It's very inexpensive because it's a very old book and there's lots of versions available. But I'll also put a link. You can go to YouTube and you can listen to it for free. Completely free. All 4 hours. Very well. There's several versions. I found one. Guy's got kind of a, I want to say a little bit of an English accent. Not really sure. More like he's a voice actor. I mean, professional, excellent narration. So you get the whole thing like it's designed as a story. It's free. I'm going to tell you this. I'm not proud of this. I've practically begged my son and daughter-in-law to listen to this. They won't do it. My own kid won't listen to me about this. They're doing better than they've ever done. But they're still spending money that they don't have. I would say they're spending money they don't have. They're not saving money that they need to be saving. They're not thinking about tomorrow, only today. It saddens me, but as I always tell you with your kids, they live their own lives. It's up to you. I'm telling you what I would tell my own son. I'm asking you to take the step that I guess he's not ready to take yet. Listen. And make this part of your life. Whatever we do long enough, we get good at. If you spend most of your life spending money as soon as you get it, you get very good at doing it. In fact, you get so good at doing it, you think you're doing well because you get very good at making yourself comfortable with what you have, but building no reserve, no battery. Right? Sean knows the whole segment today on batteries. No battery. No ability to survive a number of days forward, in the words of Buckminster Fuller. That's wealth. How long can you go if you're cut off from your income today? You can live a lavish lifestyle. Never struggle to pay a bill. My nephew and his wife, my niece-in-law, I guess you'd call her, right? They do this. They make more money than me. But I think if they got their income cut off, they might be 3 months before they're in really, really bad shape. I've talked to them about it. Prophet hath no honor in his own country. A couple hundred thousand people tune into an audio version of this show once it hits the syndication networks. Tons of people listen. Tons of people act. But people closest to me don't. Don't let that happen to you. Just because you're comfortable doesn't mean you're well off. Well off means that wherever your money comes from, if it stops tomorrow, you could be a year. If you can't go a year, you have less than a year of wealth. And if you could go a year, but at the end of that year, you have nothing left, you have 1 year of wealth. If you're 40 years old, you've been working since you're 20, you've put 20 years of your life to something, you've only built 1 year of wealth. You got another 20 years, you're going to be 60. 2 years of wealth, is that enough? I dare say not. You can either listen to me or you can listen to people like Susie Orman and say, it's the new normal, you're going to work till you're 77. I don't want you to work till you're 77. Not doing anything that you don't want to do anyway. Don't worry about spending your Bitcoin. Don't worry about spending your money. Worry about earning as much as you can, doing things that you actually want to do, and build wealth in your life. And when you spend money, spend it based on what you want, not what some retard on the internet says. I think that makes sense. Anyway, with that, I'm sorry that this was a chopped up week, I guess, with some rewinds at the end of last week. I guess Monday's Memorial Day. I didn't even think of that, so I won't be here Monday. I will have a Friday flashback for you tomorrow, and hopefully this crud will be gone, and we'll be back to our normalcy going through the full summer. Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.